Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Wayne Kustenbaum. Hello, Wayne.
Hello, Vic. Glad to be here.
Wayne joins us by telephone from, it sounds like, somewhere in Manhattan.
Yes, Chelsea, noisy 10th Avenue.
I hear those lovely car horns in the distance, probably a taxi cab.
Exactly, and it isn't even rush hour yet.
You've put out another collection of essays. It's just coming out. It's called My 1980s and Other Essays. And I've got to admit, after finishing this book, you've turned me on to so many things that I want to know more about. How did this collection come about? I'm guessing a lot of these were essays that you wrote for various publications.
Yes, they were. But I only accept assignments when I love the provocation that the assignment offers. So the assignment is when an editor approaches me to write an essay about an artist or a writer or something like that, a dance begins, in a sense, so that they feel self-generated in a funny way, though they are generated by others or catalyzed by others. May I ask you, what were some of the zones that the book led you to that you want to explore further?
I want to read more Hart Crane, more Frank O'Hara, more John Ashbery. I was really intrigued by your stuff on Forrest Bess. I had never heard of this person.
Oh, yeah, Forrest Bess. I want to call him Forrest, as if he were my pal. Forrest is extremely obscure. He's basically self-taught artist who lived in Texas in the mid-20th century. He's been kind of rediscovered by a portion of the art world, at least recently. And the infamous thing that he did was essentially castrate himself as an attempt to attain some sort of orgasmic utopia on behalf of all mankind. So he was a little bit nuts, but he was a great abstract painter.
And he had a way with a palette knife.
He did. He liked, instead of using the brush, at least the parts of the paintings that I like the best, he seems to use the palette knife, which is really not a sharp implement. It's kind of a dull butter knife. And you can see the striations that the knife makes on his canvases, and I find that very sensual.
And you state that his subject was time.
Yes, because we're all stuck in time, and I feel particularly driven to speak about time for whatever reason. His paintings need time to look at and appreciate, and if you don't give them time, they won't unveil their meaning, so that as I gaze at the painting, the painting begins to seem an argument for the very time I'm investing in it, an argument for us spending more time permitting reverie.
Wayne Kustenbaum joins us, and he has a new collection of essays out. I think a lot of people probably know you as a poet. You wear a lot of hats, don't you? Could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my hats. My formal training is as a literary critic. I have a PhD in English, and I've earned my living most of my adult life by teaching at universities in English departments. And I've written some literary criticism and continue to do so, and there's a bunch of it in this book. But I've branched out also into what I guess you could call cultural criticism. I write about art, music, mostly classical music. Obscenity, in a sense, has become a subject of mine. I wrote a book called Humiliation. I'm interested in celebrity and pop culture. I wrote a book many years ago about the icon of Jackie Onassis. I also wrote an opera libretto called Jackie O with the music by Michael Dougherty for the Houston Grand Opera a while back. Poetry has been the most continuous thread in my literary life. And recently, maybe the last 3 years, I've become a painter as well. That doesn't come up much in this book. But painting has kind of arrived in my life because of my immersion in the paintings of others.
Well, last summer we had you on for Humiliation, and I thoroughly enjoyed that book.
Thank you.
I guess if we had to give you a very short, pithy bio, we could just call you a sentence factory.
Yeah, that's my term for myself. It's not fun to be a sentence factory, and maybe you as a radio host and a public speaker feel sometimes also trapped by the sentences you have to speak. Sentences are complicated beasts, and they are little machines. And I've spent many years just continually producing them and making them and turning myself into the engine capable of producing them. And sometimes the engine wants to just shut off.
You seem to be a man with many obsessions. And just reading some of these essays, the way that you dive straight into it and you take us so far down, I think I had to pick a favorite essay. It would be this one where you do that. It's Privacy in the Films of Lana Turner. I love this essay. And
hey, thank you.
Whoa, what a bizarre thing.
I really loved writing that essay, and I wrote that a lot. That's one of the earliest ones in the collection. I wrote it in the summer of 1999, I think, and ever since then I've wanted to reproduce the experience I had writing that essay, which was basically that I was asked to write an essay by the poet Molly Peacock for an anthology about privacy. So that was the subject, privacy, and I could write about anything I wanted. And so I thought, you know, I kind of want to have a little Lana Turner film festival in my apartment. I mean, I haven't really seen many of her films, so why don't I write about privacy in the films of Lana Turner? And without any particular idea whether there would be any privacy in the films of Lana Turner, but setting that up as a kind of conceptual assignment. And so then I kept a diary of my Lana Turner film festival. I'd watch a film, and then the next morning I would write up a few paragraphs about it, and the journal continues over the summer with events of my life and some public events like the death of John F. Kennedy Jr., which happened that August, and that ends up getting folded into the essay. I would love to do that again. I don't know who it would be this time, who would be the occasion for the film festival.
Well, I think some of our younger listeners don't even know who Lana Turner was, and
oh my God! Do you want me to say?
Yeah, let's talk about her a little bit, because I think that she's fascinating, and you even have some quotes from her daughter Cheryl Crane's autobiography, where you write things that she said, you reiterate them, and it's pretty amazing to see that she wrote that her mom's life was a movie.
Yeah.
And that she realized after she went and saw Peyton Place a little bit more about who her mother really was.
Oh, that's a great moment. Well, let me tell the younger listeners that Lana Turner was a great film beauty, a Hollywood star from a little around Elizabeth Taylor's vintage, but maybe a little older. She also started young, like Elizabeth Taylor. She was known as the Sweater Girl because of a certain sweater she wore in one of her first movies that flattered her figure, and she became a kind of pinup. And she was a blonde, but probably a fake blonde, or certainly as the years passed, a fake blonde. She was before Marilyn Monroe and part of a much kind of chillier blonde type, film type. Marilyn Monroe is warmer, more natural, more vulnerable and sympathetic and sexier in a way. And Lana Turner was a little more kind of in a step in the progression from Jean Harlow to Marilyn Monroe to the more kind of natural actresses like Meryl Streep and others of the 70s. Mm. So, you know, Lana Turner's old Hollywood glamour. And the thing that she's most infamous for is that her daughter, Cheryl Crane, allegedly killed Lana's lover, Johnny Stompanato, a gangster, in Lana's bedroom. Hmm. I mean, he actually died. That's not alleged. The question was, how did he die? And it was asserted that it was Lana's daughter who did it. But there's been always a lot of gossip and thinking about this case, and it was really a scandal.
And when you look at the relationship between Lana and her daughter Cheryl, you feel the connection with your own family history, your mother battling your sister, your mother battling her mother. There's all this resonation going on.
Yes, it's really intense. I think I'm thinking of maybe you're referring to, there's a specific moment in Cheryl Crane's autobiography called Detour where she remembers when she first saw, I think, Peyton Place, and she had never been allowed to see any, or maybe it was Imitation of Life, she had never been allowed to see any of her mother's movies. She was already a 16-year-old or something, and then she finally saw one, and she realized when she saw her mother on screen issue these kind of icy reprimands to the woman who on screen was playing Lana's daughter, Cheryl said, oh my God, that's just what happens at home.
Uh-huh.
So that the things I'm enduring at home are just more part of mom's acting tricks.
Uh-huh.
And it's a pretty psychedelic moment for the reader of this book to imagine Cheryl, the real daughter of Lana Turner, discovering some fact about her mother in the movie theater.
Huh. Wow.
That's about time in a funny way. You know, I said I like to talk about time. It's about time because, you know, Lana Turner isn't famous so much anymore. She was a big star from an era before my birth, really, the 50s, 40s and 50s. And so that even thinking about her, well, now talking about her now, I wrote the essay in 1999. So there's just these layers of time. And I get kind of a lot of uncanny feelings when I'm sort of swerving between the decades like that.
Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. His new book is My 1980s and Other Essays. On the cover, you have this wonderful photo of Debbie Harry, the singer from Blondie. Is she still your neighbor?
You know, she is. I don't see her as much as I used to. I used to always see her walking her dog on 23rd Street, and I guess she's touring or busy. But I hear that she still lives. She's lived in this apartment building for years. I should say it's a huge apartment building with thousands of people in it. It's probably the largest single apartment building in New York City, so it's easy to get lost here. Susan Sontag also used to live in this building, and she's a subject of another one of the essays. So it's a pretty local book in a funny way. John Ashbery, the poet, subject of another essay, lives around the block on 22nd Street. But Debbie Harry, I was so happy to get that picture. It's a Warhol Polaroid, to get that permission to use that picture on the cover. She's kind of another version of Lana Turner, the fake blonde, the not exactly icy demeanor, but a sense of a person who relishes her participation in things plastic.
Mm. And you see her in the grocery, you see her on the street. Have you ever been tempted to speak to her? I know this is New York and that's verboten, but have you ever had words with her?
I've never had words with her. I once, very recently, maybe about 6 months ago, we almost collided with each other because she was rounding one corner and I was rounding another, and she kind of was, I startled her inadvertently, and that was the closest I've come. I'm not very good at approaching my idols.
Mm.
And I in my book about Jackie Under My Skin, I write at the beginning about the one time I actually stood in a conversation with a real Jacqueline Onassis the year before she died at a book party. I remember looking at my feet the whole time. She was talking to a person. I was talking to a person who knew Jackie, and then that person, Jackie, maybe came over to talk to the person I was talking with. And there was a moment where I was in a little conversation with Jackie, but it was just the sense of the sacred and the inviolable that surrounded her. It seemed rude to even look at her. And I remember just looking at my feet and feeling that I was mishandling this opportunity. But I also felt a lot of shame or humiliation at that moment because I knew I was writing a book about Jackie and felt that she probably, were she ever to read the book, or that it was probably not the kind of thing she liked people to be doing, writing books about her.
I don't suppose. Your essays are so personal. You just mentioned Susan Sontag, John Ashbery. You talk about having dreams about them. That's very personal to put in an essay.
But dreams are, it is, I guess. But, you know, dreams are also very impersonal because they come at us unbidden. We don't, and they're not things that have really happened. So if I say, it seems easier for me to admit something I dreamt than something that really happened. I admit plenty of things that really happened too, but
you do.
I never feel like I'm disclosing that much when I mention dreams.
Okay. You have a quote in here where you say, some people obsessively re-examine their lives. Others straightforwardly endure them. I would rather be one who endures. Instead, I am an examiner.
It's true. I also endure my life, and I actually enjoy it. And it may be, again, I think that's from the Lana Turner essay in 1999. So I think I'm probably doing now a little less examination and a little more enduring. Or else the examination feels less stringent. It has a more spacious pace.
Well, I wish we had 20 minutes for you to describe Debbie Harry's ineffable gorgeousness and irony, but we don't.
And not even 30 seconds? Well, I guess I just used up the 30 seconds.
Oh, my. The book is My 1980s and Other Essays. Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. And you've got a lot of stuff in here. This statement that literature is private in comparison to film, in comparison to painting, in comparison to so many other forms of art. Yet it isn't really private, is it? If it's out there
private
for people to read it?
Right, and it can be so specifically revealing in a way that a painting can never be. I mean, even if I do a nude self-portrait, it's still just a painting of me. I suppose a photograph would be more revealing, but in writing you can reveal actually what you felt about events, and so you're showing more than just what meets the eye. And but I say literature is private because the unless you go to a public reading, which is really not the way most of us absorb literature, we're hearing it or reading it in private. And I write my books in private in my room or study, and I don't see the people reading them, if people ever read them. That happens after, you know, I wrote that essay in 1999, you read it in 2013. I didn't see you read it. We're coincidentally talking about it, so I know that you read it, but it's kind of like that, whatever the line is about if a tree falls in a forest and no one's there to hear it, or the sound of one hand clapping. Literature kind of goes out there like a cloud, and and a lot of the books I read are by dead people. So it's really private then.
True. One of your essays in here is called Assignments, and I chuckled a lot reading this one, and I'm wondering, are any of these assignments things that you actually did?
I must tell you, they are all assignments that I actually gave.
Okay.
Some of them, and most of the assignments I give are things that I've done in one form or another or would like to do. But in various writing classes, classes on the essay that I've taught at the graduate program here at the City University of New York, I've given all of those assignments.
Oh, so these are assignments you gave your class.
Yeah. Okay. I think my students like my assignments. They say they do.
They probably like some of them more than others.
Or some students like them more than other students do.
Yeah. Like the one, write about a witch or warlock you know.
Oh, that's a fun one. I think everybody liked that one. We were reading that week we were reading in class a book, a novel by Sylvia Townsend Warner called Lolly Willows, which is about a witch. And so it was directly tied into the reading.
You have an essay in here about Diane Arbus and her photos. And since you're an expert on humiliation, you're wondering if her photo subjects felt humiliated by the photos. And for those who are familiar with her work, she took pictures of some pretty unusual subjects.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one that's coming to mind right now is of, like, I think she subtitles it or captions it, Jewish giant at home with his parents.
Uh-huh. I love that photo.
It's really amazing because there's this, we take her word for it that he's Jewish, but he's certainly a giant. And his parents are about half of his size. He can barely fit in the room that he's in. The furniture, everything looks humiliated in the room. The furniture may be most humiliated of all because it's so inadequate to his demands. I mean, how can he, there's nothing he can sit on there. I mean, it's quite something. But the thing about Diane Arbus from Patricia Bosworth's biography of him, she befriended her subjects and I think established very equilateral relations with them, and so didn't overtly humiliate them.
One thing that really struck me about all these essays was somewhere along the line you make the statement that you look at people's noses very closely and that you're really attracted to big noses. And I'm another person that really likes to look at noses. I think noses say a lot about people.
That's an amazing comment. I'm so thrilled to hear you say that. I don't know that I look at noses more than at other parts, but I know that in the Debbie Harry essay, I do say that about noses because Debbie Harry's face is particularly arresting because her cheekbones are so wide and huge, and her nose is so small. Really delicate little nose, and I have a somewhat big nose, not as big as they get, but a large nose, and I like both. I mean, I probably idealize the faces that have small noses, but when I see a big nose, I feel a stirring of a kind of proud identification.
Hmm. In one of the essays, I think it was an essay about Warhol, they're all blurring together in my mind at the moment. You mentioned Taylor Mead, and I remembered reading his obit recently in the New York Times. What a fascinating man.
Wow, no, totally a lost type, like a true bohemian, beatnik, free spirit, self-professed freak, underground film star, a follower of Warhol, but also somebody who inspired Warhol. Star of Warhol movies, a really interesting poet. I actually gave a reading with him downtown in New York at a place called the Zinc Bar.
You did?
Yeah, about 15 years ago. And the funny thing about Taylor Mead, he often did this at readings, is he brought a tape recorder along with him as a kind of accompaniment, like a musical accompaniment. So he'd, I don't remember the details, but he definitely had this like really sort of rinky-dink old cassette recorder that he had as a kind of ukulele with him, and he was pretty out of it and just like not a very focused person. I also interviewed him in the late 90s for my Warhol biography. When I was writing that, and took him out to dinner at a restaurant in Soho, and I remember him sort of making it clear, I think I said I would pay him $100 for the interview, just against journalist ethics, but I thought it's what I owed these people. Since they never got any money from Warhol for what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him kind of saying, suggesting quite firmly that we go to this specific Italian restaurant that he really liked. It's a pretty expensive one in Soho. And I got a sense of, oh, this is how he gets a lot of his meals.
Uh-huh.
I think we first met for drink somewhere, and then he suggested, let's go to blah, this very expensive restaurant. Good for Taylor.
Well, he was obviously a survivor, and now I'm flashing on where you dropped his name. I'm remembering you were making a movie, but we won't talk about that essay.
No, I was going to mention the title of it, but I don't want you to have to edit it out.
I remembered when you mentioned the $100, that's something clicked.
You're a careful reader.
Well, I have a good memory. That's
certainly
for sure. I forgot for a second, but now I remember. And yeah, there's some essays in here that we probably don't want to talk about on the radio.
Oh, I'm glad. I don't want to talk about them even off the radio.
Oh, good. Okay, the book is My 1980s and Other Essays. Wayne Kustenbaum joins us. And Wayne informed me before we started taping this interview that this is his first radio interview for the book, and we're thrilled to be able to be first. We beat Terry Gross to it for once.
Oh, yeah. No, she's really late on this one. Shame on Terry.
Okay. And I'm sure, knowing you, you're in the middle of a bunch of projects. Are there any that you can talk about?
Well, other than painting, which is, I have now actually a studio, and I'm painting quite rapidly and exhibiting my work. I'm writing a book-length poem that I've been writing really for a year in notebooks, autobiographical. Not much to say about it, really, except that, like all projects, when I'm in the midst of them, it feels like the most burning necessity and the repository of all the secrets that I've never until now disclosed.
Oh. Have you read the Rakoff book?
I haven't yet, okay. But I knew him a little bit. He was a really, really sweet guy.
That's what everyone says. I regret that I never was able to interview him.
Yes, very, very sweet, and clearly, you know, had an ironic edge that I relished.
I really was kind of tickled by a lot of these essays because, as I mentioned when we started, you've given me some names and some faces to look for as I try to find other things to read. And when I read this one about Play-Doh Fun Factory Poetics, that really made me think about the creative process and just how we look at our own creativity. That's the one where I think you talk about how you're a sentence factory.
Exactly. And lest the listener misunderstand, I mean, of course, not Plato the philosopher, P-L-A-T-O, or a character in Rebel Without a Cause played by Sal Mineo, but Play-Doh, you know, the toy, the kind of weird-smelling clay thing that you mold. And I don't know if they still make them, but when I was a kid, a prized toy was a Play-Doh Fun Factory where you extruded the Play-Doh out this little aperture into these to make these nifty little shapes.
Yeah, those were fun. You didn't play with one, though, did you?
I didn't own one, but I did. I went to a friend's house, and he had one. And I suppose if I were really somebody who endured my life rather than examined it, I would order on eBay a Play-Doh Fun Factory and just start playing, but instead I examine it.
Well, I'm looking at the clock and I'm seeing that the time has flown, and it's really been a pleasure having you back on the program again.
Oh, I could talk to you forever, so thanks. Invite me back another time.
You're very kind, and knowing you, you'll have another book out probably in the next 5 minutes. No, I'm just kidding.
Not five, but maybe 15.
Okay. My guest has been Wayne Kustenbaum. His book is My 1980s and Other Essays. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Wayne Kustenbaum. If you go to the Book Nook page on the WYSO website at wyso.org, you can listen to our interview for Wayne's book, Humiliation, that we did last year. That podcast is on the website. Or check out more than 100 other podcasts of Book Nook interviews on WYSO.org. There's 4 interviews by James Lee Burke on there. Check it out. WYSO.org. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.